Now let's see what it says in this morning's newspapers. Join us, Angus Cox.
13 years after her disappearance while on holiday with her family on the Algarve coast in Portugal, Madeleine McCann is pictured on the front of no fewer than five papers. News that a German prisoner has been identified as the prime suspect in the case is described in the Irish Independent as the biggest breakthrough to date. The Irish Daily Star reports the unnamed 43-year-old, who was in prison on an unrelated matter, lived in a campervan at the time in the area where Madeleine went missing. The campervan is pictured on the front of the Irish Sun, which asks, did German take Maddie in this van? While the Irish Daily Mail says British detectives have launched an information appeal about the van, as well as a Jaguar car seen in the area that's linked to the suspect. The Irish Times reports public health officials are set to give the go-ahead today for a further easing of COVID restrictions, with only minor changes to the government's initial roadmap. Resuming certain special education classes and allowing some summer camps to go ahead are said to be among the measures. The Independent reports the pandemic unemployment payment for part-time workers will be reduced by 40% as part of the government's plan to cut the massive welfare bill that's mounted up due to the coronavirus situation. The paper says the €350 weekly payment will fall to €203 in line with the job seekers' allowance. The Belfast Telegraph leads with reopening proposals from primary schools in Northern Ireland. Among the measures, which the paper says a number of Belfast schools have come up with in the absence of official guidance, are daily temperature checks, a two-day school week, and emotional well-being lessons. The Irish Examiner says November 12th has been set as the date for the reopening of Douglas Shopping Centre in Cork, which closed on the 31st of August last after a major fire destroyed a key part of the retail complex. Catherine Shanahan writes the reopening will see the reinstatement of 1,000 much-needed car parking spaces in the suburb, as well as the reopening of 46 commercial units. Separately, the Examiner reports Fine Gael wants greenhouse gases linked to cattle emitted from emission calculations targeted by the Greens in government formation negotiations. The Irish Farmers Journal also has details of this week's talks, which have dealt extensively with agriculture. It says Fine Gael has proposed that carbon tax revenue be dedicated to a new agri-environmental programme described as REPS Mark II. The journal adds the move would see farmers rewarded for initiatives such as reducing farm emissions and enhancing biodiversity. The Times, meanwhile, says independent TDs have been offered deals similar to that given to former Kerry independent Jackie Healy-Ray in order to support a coalition between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens. Such an agreement, which would involve local deals for individual TDs as well as access to ministers, was reportedly made at a meeting between the three party leaders, which was attended by deputies Marion Harkin, Michael Fitzmaurice and Michael McNamara. Finally, to the letter pages in the Times, where Keith Nolan from Carrick-on-Shannon, County Leitrim, writes Dalkey in County Dublin seems to be making national news these days. First, there was an extended stay from Hollywood film star Matt Damon, and now a hole has appeared on one of its streets, Mr. Nolan notes. Adding, it's all so exciting for us, so far away from these momentous events. Norman Lowther in Raheny in Dublin also sees the humorous side of a sinkhole in Dalkey, suggesting perhaps it was caused by the mat being pulled from out or from under them. While Dalkey resident Paul Delaney keeps the light-sided theme going, asking, are Gardaí looking into it?
The former US Defence Secretary James Mattis has denounced President Donald Trump, accusing him of stoking division and abusing his authority. In rare public comments, Mr. Mattis, who resigned in 2018, said the president had sought to divide the American people and had failed to provide mature leadership. Four white police officers have been charged now in relation to the killing of African-American George Floyd in Minneapolis last week. The officer seen on video with his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck has had his charge upgraded to a second-degree murder. Largely peaceful protests over his death continued last night. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan joins us now. Brian, will you bring us up to date on the protests? Were they as widespread as previous nights?
Yes, the protests certainly did take place overnight in cities such as New York, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and here in Washington, D.C. Now, I was down at the White House protest again yesterday. There was a very, very heavy security presence, and that security perimeter around the White House had been widened even further, meaning the protesters were further back than previous days. But I have to say the atmosphere was calm, it was peaceful, and it seems that in general, overnight, the protests across the U.S. were largely peaceful. Now, thousands of people remained on the streets in many cities in defiance of various curfews, and there have been several arrests in the likes of Los Angeles and New York. Overnight, however, a number of mayors announced that they were ending their curfews over the coming days. Now, last night, as you mentioned there, prosecutors announced further criminal charges following the killing of George Floyd. Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on Mr. Floyd's neck, is now facing second-degree murder, an upgrade from an original charge of third-degree murder. Three other police officers who were fired following the incident were charged with aiding and abetting. So the big question is, will these new charges bring an end to these protests? And I don't necessarily know if that is the case, because remember, yes, George Floyd was the spark of this wave of protest and unrest, but I think it's become a much wider movement, highlighting racial inequality, highlighting division, and highlighting injustice here in the US. In the coming hours later today, Audrey, in Minneapolis, the first in a series of memorial services for George Floyd will be held ahead of his funeral next week.
And certainly increasing criticism of Donald Trump's handling of the situation. Will you talk to us about the significance of his former Defense Secretary James Mattis adding his voice to that criticism?
Yeah, a stinging criticism from James Mattis, who had remained largely quiet since leaving the Trump administration. He was writing The Atlantic magazine, and he accused Donald Trump of trying to divide America and failing to provide mature leadership. He said he was a threat to the Constitution, and he even made comparisons with Nazi Germany, saying US troops were reminded before the Normandy invasion, the Nazi slogan for destroying us was divide and conquer. Now, Donald Trump very much firing back last night on Twitter. He said that Jim Mattis was an overrated general, and that he was glad that he'd asked for his resignation. Now, also weighing in on all of this last night was former US President Barack Obama. He spoke about the current wave of protest in an online town hall event. He thanked protesters. He said he felt very hopeful about their calls for change. He urged demonstrators to follow up their actions now by voting in November's election. And he also said he felt these protests were different to previous movements.
There is something different here. You look at those protests, and that was a far more representative cross-section of America out on the streets, peacefully protesting, and who felt moved to do something because of the injustices that they had seen. That didn't exist back in the 1960s, that kind of broad coalition. The fact that recent surveys have showed that despite some protests having been marred by the actions of some, a tiny minority that engaged in violence, that despite, you know, as usual, that got a lot of attention, a lot of focus. Despite all that, a majority of Americans still think those protests were justified. That wouldn't have existed 30, 40, 50 years ago. There is a change in mindset that's taking place, a greater recognition that we can do better.
Former President Barack Obama. It's not just former leaders and former defense secretaries who are speaking out about the current unrest, Brian. There's also divisions within President Trump's own administration.
That's right, yeah, because on Monday night, you'll remember that Donald Trump threatened to deploy the US military to restore order. For that to happen, he would have to invoke what's known as the Insurrection Act. But at a press briefing yesterday, President Trump's own defense secretary, Mark Esper, said he did not support that idea of deploying US troops to US cities. He said that's something that should only be done in a matter of last resort in the most urgent and dire of situations, and he said we're not there right now. Mark Esper had decided yesterday to actually send military troops home from Washington, D.C. to their home bases. But that decision was then reversed later on in the day following a meeting in the White House. So there's a real sense here in Washington right now that Mark Esper's job could be on the line. He could be in jeopardy, and he's on very shaky ground. The White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, was asked about all of this by reporters yesterday. She said, as of now, he remains as the defense secretary. And if that changes, you'll be the first to know. So hardly a ringing endorsement.
Brian, thank you. Brian O'Donovan live from Washington, D.C. Later in the programme, we'll be speaking to the former U.S. Ambassador to Ireland, Kevin O'Malley, in discussion with Professor Melanie McAllister. It's nearly 20 past seven now.
Police have a new suspect in their investigation into the disappearance 13 years ago in Portugal of British child Madeleine McCann. The suspect, who hasn't been named, is a German national, a convicted sex offender known to have been in the Algarve region at the time and currently serving a prison sentence. Madeleine McCann disappeared from her parents' Algarve apartment in May 2007, shortly before her fourth birthday. Sky News correspondent Enda Brady has more on this for us. Enda, what can you tell us?
Good morning, Brian. Well, this man hasn't been named, but we know he's 43. He is a German national. He is a convicted paedophile. He's currently serving a prison sentence in Germany. But Portuguese police and British police are very interested in him in relation to the disappearance of Madeleine McCann way back in May 2007. Now, apparently his name was given to Portuguese police on the 10th anniversary, which was 3 years ago. So what we know about this guy is that he had been living in a ramshackle old farm building on a very remote hillside above the beach at Praia da Luz, which he left that property about a year before Madeleine's disappearance, but he seems to have stayed in the area. He had a Volkswagen camper van. He also had a battered old Jaguar. And police, while they haven't released his name, they are looking for information about those two vehicles. They've released pictures of the vehicles. They say that he was definitely in Praia da Luz on the night of Madeleine's disappearance. He took a call on his Portuguese mobile. They've released the mobile number, and they've also released the number that called his mobile. And that call lasted for precisely half an hour, and it was in the run-up to the hour that Madeleine vanished. So police are very, very keen to gather more intelligence about this man, more information about his movements on the night. And I think what makes him suspicious is that the very next morning he re-registered one of those vehicles in the name of someone else and basically vanished. So German police are looking for more information, Portuguese detectives, and indeed detectives here in London as well.
And I suppose it's a measure of the scale of this investigation that something like 600 people have been come to the attention or been regarded as of some significance, and the emergence of this individual followed an appeal in 2017 on the 10th anniversary of the disappearance.
Yes, his name was given to detectives on the 10th anniversary, and Portuguese police, we understand, have been speaking to people in the area. This guy apparently did stand out. His driving was appalling. He always seemed to have an angry demeanour about him, and he was known in the area. What police know is that he was definitely in Praia da Luz on the night of Madeleine's disappearance. This phone call, for whatever reason, has flagged up as suspicious. Half an hour phone call in the run-up to Madeleine's disappearance, and then the re-registering of the vehicle the very next morning. So detectives desperate for more information. They haven't released his name. As we understand it, he is currently serving a prison sentence in Germany.
And the appeal, Enda, has been welcomed by the McCanns, by Madeleine's parents. They say that they've never given up hope of finding her alive, but of course there have been many false leads in the past.
Yeah, there have been so many Madeleine stories over the years. I mean, it's front page news today, and it always will be. And the McCanns say that they will never give up hope until someone tells them and proves that their daughter is no longer living. They will always believe that she is out there, and they will keep searching for her. Mm.
Just separately, Enda, because I gather you were in Downing Street in London last evening, and of course, across the UK, there have been protests associated with the Black Lives Matter movement. For the most part, peaceable demonstrations, but there were some rather ugly scenes in Downing Street last evening. What did you see?
Yeah, it turned very unpleasant. Just about 8 o'clock last night, I arrived on Whitehall, which is the road that runs from Parliament Square all the way down to Trafalgar Square. And then you have the Foreign Office, which is one road off to the left, and Downing Street is the next road off. Mm-hmm. So there was about 300 protesters. I've been in Lewisham in South London at a protest outside a police station there. It was completely peaceful, very respectful. People made their point and they left. I then went up to Westminster. I received a tip-off that there was some trouble there. And sure enough, basically people throwing bottles at the police. At one stage, the barricades outside Downing Street, which politicians and press use to, it's a walkway that before you enter Downing Street, people were ripping those barricades apart to use them as weapons. At one stage, I saw a police truck come under bottles being thrown out under fire, and police forming a ring of steel around the police truck to enable their colleagues to reverse and get away. It was deeply unpleasant. And then an Australian camera crew from Channel 9, Ben Avery is their Europe correspondent, he was about to go live, and he had to run for his life, basically. They had to flee to safety because the mob turned on the media. And it got really unpleasant. It really, really did. That went on for several hours. And I think the one point to make, Brian, I think the police had been so light-handed in their policing of the protests all day, they ended up being outnumbered last night at points.
All right. And we leave it there. Enda Brady from Sky News. Thanks very much indeed for that. Just 25 past seven.
If you're buying your edition of British Vogue today, there's a big change to the front cover. Instead of the usual model or celebrity gracing the front cover, there's a midwife and a supermarket worker and a train driver. They represent the new front line, three women who have put their lives on the line during the COVID-19 pandemic. The midwife in question is Rachel Miller from near Cookstown in County Tyrone, and who works as a midwife in the Homerton Hospital in East London. And she's on the line now. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. It's a gorgeous photograph of you. Are you happy with it?
Yeah, I'm more than happy with it. I don't think I would have minded what went up there, but it's just
honour. It's really lovely. How did it all come about?
So I was just doing a normal shift on labour ward, caring for a labouring woman, and they came out of the room to get something, and Jamie, the photographer, was there, and he just took photos of everyone on shift that day. So all we knew was that Vogue was doing some sort of feature on key workers during the pandemic, but we had no idea that there was potential for it to end up on the cover. So I heard a couple of weeks after that that they'd chosen my portrait to go on the cover.
And what did you think?
I didn't believe them at the start. It's not something you ever imagine would happen to you. So it was a bit surreal. It still is.
Yeah, absolutely. And no time for hair and makeup. All done very naturally and very much on the front line of your workplace.
Yes, exactly.
Why does this matter to you, Rachel? Why does it matter for everyone that yourself and the supermarket worker and the London Underground train driver are on the front of Vogue this week?
There definitely has been a shift in who Vogue kind of portray as role models, and the fact that they've put three ordinary people on the cover instead of a model or a celebrity for this issue. I hope that it's a reminder to people who see it that everyday jobs can make a difference. You don't have to have a huge huge following on social media or anything like that to make a difference.
Will you talk to us a little bit about your work and how it has changed during the pandemic?
Yeah, so I'm a community midwife, and that means I do antenatal clinics face-to-face with women, you know, the whole way through their pregnancy, and then postnatal home visits after they've left labour ward with their newborns. And a lot of the appointments have changed to be over the telephone instead of face-to-face, which I think is really hard for the women and their families to get used to, because there's just not that same level of support. We're trying our best to make them feel supported and put in things in place that so that nothing is missed, but I think there's a lot of anxiety around it, so there's a lot of reassurance needs to happen for ourselves and for them, because I think if we come across as very anxious, it kind of radiates onto them.
Did any of your mothers have it?
We have had quite a few women, yeah. It's all quietened down recently, but at the height of the pandemic, we had quite a few people on labour ward and in the community, but we still had to go and see them because there's certain things that need to happen throughout the pregnancy or in the first few days of a newborn's life that we have to offer. So regardless of whether they were suspected or a positive result of COVID, we still had to go in.
But you were okay? You didn't get sick?
No, I haven't yet.
No, that's good. Yeah, I mean, it's a very worrying time for you and your family and all involved on the front line. And I just thought, you know, in recent months, your colleagues in Northern Ireland had to go on strike many days in the rain to protest, to look for a few more pounds to their salaries. What are you expecting after this, Rachel? Do you expect your role and the role of others on the front line to be valued properly when it's over?
I hope so. I think in maternity, we've been very fortunate in that we get a lot of love and recognition purely for the nature of our job. You know, we're involved in a really momentous time in people's lives, so they often remember that, and there is a lot of thanks in it. But it's really nice to see roles in the NHS that maybe previously weren't as recognised before, not recognised, but, you know, not as much appreciation shown for their department, to get that recognition this time round. And I know, like, the CLAPS is going to end, and or already has, and the free meals, that's not going to continue forever. But I just hope the kindness that's been shown and the patience with the NHS whilst we, like, you know, get used to this pandemic and make so many changes, I just hope that continues after all of this ends.
Absolutely. And just finally, will there be a big run on British Vogue in Cookstown in Coke in Tyrone today?
I'd imagine so, yeah. I'm imagining my mum will probably be at Tesco tomorrow buying all the copies she can find.
Absolutely. Rachel, it's lovely talking to you, and thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning.
Thanks.
That's
so
Rachel
much.
Miller, midwife and Vogue front cover star. She's on the front cover of British Vogue, which goes on sale from tomorrow.
Now, let's take a look at the business headlines. A first look at the business headlines this Thursday morning with Brian Finn. Good morning, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning. Mortgage approvals were down over 40% in volume and value terms in the month of April, according to the Banking and Payments Federation. Just 2,200 mortgages to the value of €525 million were approved in the first full month of pandemic restrictions. About half of approvals were accounted for by first-time buyers, a further quarter by those who were moving house. Activity in the country's services sector fell in May at its second fastest rate in the near 20-year history of the Purchasing Managers Index. However, the fall in activity eased notably compared to the near collapse in activity in the services sector in April, according to AIB. Employment continued to fall and the outlook for next year remains under pressure, but there was a slight improvement on April. The Dublin-listed pharmaceutical services company Open Orphan is to launch its COVID antibody testing service in London today. It follows the successful completion of installation, testing and training of its systems. Antibody tests can inform if a person has had COVID and can assist in mapping the spread of the virus. On the currencies this morning, the euro is trading at $1.12 and around 89.5 pence sterling.
The National Public Health Emergency Team meets today to consider whether there should be a further easing of the COVID-19 restrictions as planned under the government's roadmap for reopening the country. The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, said last night there was nothing in the latest data to suggest that NPHET wouldn't recommend moving to phase two of the reopening on Monday. Let's talk to our correspondent, Sinead Crowley. Good morning, Sinead.
Good morning.
Perhaps, first of all, you might just explain to us why the latest figures for infections and for fatalities are giving this grounds to believe that despite the fact that there are continuing new cases of infection, that in fact on Monday the view seems to be that we can now move towards a further easing of the restrictions.
Yes, keeping a close eye, obviously, on the figures, all of the public health officials for the last couple of weeks. It's a 3-week period between the lifting of the stages, and that's very deliberate because they reckon it takes around 2 weeks for the impact to show. So that's why week three is crucial, because now we are seeing the impact of what happened when the first easing of restrictions happened. So last night, sadly, we did hear of the death of 3 people, and we also heard of 47 confirmed new cases of COVID-19. Now, the day before had been 10, so 47 looks like a big jump. However, that was post bank holiday, so those figures were probably slightly too low. So 47 is around the figure they are looking for. The, under 100 was seen as very important, and those figures have been significantly under 100 and under 100 for quite some time at this stage. So that is seen as a very good figure. A couple of other figures given last night, for example, the recovery rate from COVID-19 is now 91%. That includes people who both recover in the community and people in hospital. So that is seen as positive. Other figures they're looking at, which are very interesting, is how this virus is transmitted, and that's worth keeping an eye on. At the moment, community transmission accounting for 39% and close contact transmission accounting for 59%. And the point was made last night, yes, the public health officials won't confirm, but it does look likely we're moving towards phase two. However, looking at that close contact figure, it's going to be up to individuals in the future to keep an eye on who their contacts are and keeping away and keeping their distancing and their social distancing and so on, as the really tight restrictions are eased, it'll be more down to the individual to watch for those close contacts, because that is still where 59% of transmission is occurring. But apart from that, yes, it does seem to be that things are moving towards a position where it will be recommended to move ahead.
And those changes then from Monday would involve what? And is there any suggestion that further easing of restrictions, a plan for a later stage in this roadmap, could be brought forward?
Well, I suppose the big things people are looking out for from Monday is the move to 20 kilometres. You're still being advised to stay at home where possible, to work at home where possible. However, you will be able to travel up to 20 kilometres away from your home as opposed to 5 at the moment. Social visits as well, people are concerned about that in terms of family. You could have up to 4 people visiting another household for a short period of time, but maintaining the 2 metres apart from people. Also, there's going to be some changes in work, for example. Remote working is to continue, as I said, if that's possible, but some small retail outlets will be reopening if the retailer can control the individuals coming in. Marts where social distancing can be maintained. Libraries, hopefully, as long as the numbers allowed in are limited, and some group exercise as well. So some changes there. There was also mention made last night of summer camps for children. Now, there has been no announcement that anything will be speeded up in terms of the phases, and that has been made quite clear as well. It's quite clear the health officials feel that the phases as they were laid out are the right way to do things, so there isn't likely to be any speeding up. However, at the NPHET meeting today, we do know that there will be discussion of the impact on children. They've said that several times, that they're aware of how hard these things have been on children, so there is a suggestion that, for example, summer camps might be mentioned. However, these will, you know, may not be the summer camps we know. There will be still restrictions, but we do know that they are going to be discussed today.
All right, no doubt more on this in the course of the day on our bulletins and online. But for the moment, Sinead Crowley, thank you very much indeed for that.
Well, we're going to Sweden next, where the country's chief epidemiologist has admitted that they should have done more to combat COVID-19. The country of over 10 million people did not impose a general lockdown in the way other countries did, and it now has one of the highest death rates from the virus in the world, at just over 4,500 deaths. Anders Tegnell said that if they were to do it again, the new approach would be something between what they did do and what the rest of the world has done. His approach, which was followed by government, has been criticised by fellow scientists. Cecilia Söderberg-Naukler is Professor of Microbial Pathogenesis at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, and was one of over 2,000 academics who signed an open letter urging the government to implement stronger measures, and she joins us now. You're very welcome indeed to Morning Ireland. What do you think of what Mr. Tegnell has now said about the approach?
I think it's very good that he has come to his senses and reflected over what we've done in Sweden and seen what the results were from that strategy as compared to other countries who've done a more stricter lockdown. I think, though, that Mr. Tegnell is not completely agreeing with that. He's retracted from his view that we have done a wrong thing, that many things that were different are actually not on the positive side that he has discussed after his statement on that they should have done other things.
Yes, he did broadly then back up his original strategy. I heard him being interviewed on the BBC World Service last night, and he said that they could have saved more older people's lives in care homes. Do you agree?
Absolutely, because I think that even though it's an excellent strategy to protect the old people, we need to have a plan to be able to do so. And there was no plan. There was not enough safety equipment. There was not recommendations on how people should go to work. There were no testing, either of personnel or the people that live in the elderly homes. So there were many things that were not prepared for a plan that we should protect people, because if you don't have a plan for how to not get the virus into these elderly homes and not protect the ones that are there through safety equipment, there is actually no way to do that.
We saw the situation in many other European countries, and indeed in the United States and beyond, about hospitals' capacity to cope. And with 40,000 plus cases in Sweden, were your hospitals able to cope?
Well, it depends on how you view that situation, because we have now not admitted most of the elderly people that have died. They have not been admitted to the hospitals. If they were, we would have had probably almost twice as many hospital bed needs as we actually ended up having. However, the strategy that we have used in Sweden has reflected over done better than we were afraid that it would do. So that means that the social distancing level has actually helped better than we feared that it would do, which means that we have flattened the curve in a way and kept people on distance, and many have been working at home. So even though this halfway measurements were done, I think that we actually did better than we foreseed.
Okay. And what in your mind still needs to happen in order to reduce this death rate?
Well, first of all, we need to test. We need to contact trace, which the authority have not done since the second week in March, because they kind of lost control already then. And we also need to isolate people more properly, because they have been on the advice of staying at home and self-isolate for 2 days after you recover, and you don't know if you're sick or not from the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So that's the most important thing. And we do think that masks should be implemented on indoor activities, for example, where crowded buses and shopping areas, which are now filling up with more and more people. So yesterday we had over 2,000 cases confirmed, and it's been below 1,000, between 300 to 700 the past few weeks. So we are actually quite concerned that people are now not respecting social distancing to the same level as it was for a month ago. So we will see where these numbers will take us, but we think that there should be stricter measurements again, and the 50 people meeting number should probably be reduced to something like 10 instead, and that is a very important signal to the people that it's the fear for this virus is far from over, and we are very concerned on what's going to happen, even though okay. They are coming up for holiday time now and people are spending more time outside, but we are seeing that people are also moving into indoor crowded spaces. Restaurants are filling up and shopping centers and so on.
Okay.
But the most important thing will be testing and contrast tracing and also isolating people properly.
Well, we will keep in touch with you, and thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning. Professor Cecilia Söderberg Naukler joining us from Sweden.
The Immigrant Council of Ireland is today reporting a big increase in the number of people using its helpline last year. The organisation says it answered some 5,000 calls during 2019. That's an increase of 1,500 on the previous year. Brian Killoran is the council's CEO, and he's on the line now and can tell us more. Very good morning, Brian Killoran. Thanks for talking to us this morning. So what's driving this big increase in calls during last year? Who's calling you and why?
Well, we, as you say, experienced a significant increase in our calls last year, which has been maintained this year, albeit we are working in different circumstances because of the pandemic. I suppose what drives the people coming to our service is access to justice, essentially. People looking for information about how to navigate our immigration system, how to get from positions of being students into positions of being workers, how to get to a more permanent and secure immigration status. But also family plays a huge part in it. It's about family reunification, how people can get spouses into the state, what their rights are when they get here. We have a slightly opaque immigration system in Ireland, a lot of which is based on discretion. So the policies are there, but it very much varies based on the person making the application. And there's not a lot of legal rights and entitlements. So in those circumstances, it's very hard for people to know what will happen when they make an immigration application. And we try to help them to navigate that process through our helpline and through our legal services.
And are you finding yourself taking calls both from people who are here already and involved in the process of with the department, as well as people from living abroad who want to move here?
The vast majority are people who are here in Ireland. So they've made Ireland their home, and they're looking to get, as I say, to a more secure status, or trying to find out what the implications are of their immigration status on other things. Like, what does it mean for my education? What does it mean for my social welfare if I need it? What does it mean for my employment? So it is predominantly people that are here, but it is also people that are looking to come here as well. We've taken calls from many countries around the world, sometimes from Irish citizens as well, who are returning to Ireland and bringing spouses and partners with them, wondering what will happen to those spouses and partners when they get here.
You've also been involved in recent times in an initiative to counter racism, which obviously is very much in people's minds at the moment with what's been happening in the United States. And in your particular initiative has focused on public transport and the public transport system as an area where people just integrate a lot and provides an opportunity to confront racist attitudes.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose the day-to-day work of our anti-racism work is supporting victims of racism. So we do provide a support service for people who can contact the organisation and get support if they've experienced something, try to find out how they might remedy the situation they're in. And sometimes it's just emotional support, having somebody to talk to, having gone through something quite difficult. But every year then as well, we work with the public transport providers across all of Ireland to do an annual campaign. And public transport's a great place to do that because it's a real source, a real point of integration for all of us. Everybody uses public transport every day, or to a large extent, at least, or in normal circumstances anyway. And it is a place where actually the staff are quite diverse and the users of public transport are quite diverse. So it sends out a message, first of all, that public transport does not tolerate incidents of racism, but it also gives us as an organisation the opportunity to say, and if you do experience something, come and get some support, because the only way we'll resolve these things is by working in unison together and giving a space for people to actually talk about what's happened to them and actually give providers like public transport providers the opportunity to push back and say, you know what, as a public space, mm-hmm. we don't tolerate this either.
And just one last question about current circumstances. Many, I think people will perhaps expect that many of those in the migrant community are working very often in frontline occupations and as a result, perhaps are at greater risk during this pandemic. Is that something that's been coming through as well?
Well, the vast majority of our calls on our helpline at the moment are COVID-19 related, and they come from people from a migrant background who are working largely in essential jobs in the healthcare system and in very important places within Irish society. And the impact on them is significant because largely a lot of the time their immigration status is quite fragile and they're wondering what the impact of that will be. So for us, that does highlight, first of all, the significant impact of migrants to Irish society working in very key sectors, but also our need to support them, to reform our immigration system, to make sure that we are supporting them adequately, to give them security. Ireland is mm-hmm. their home and they need to stay here. But also in the broader scheme of things, we have to address integration, we have to address anti-racism, we have to have a national plan to make sure that people from a migrant background in Ireland are provided with the appropriate supports, that if they experience things like racism, we're prepared for that. We're not right. just reacting to it, we're planning ahead for it.
Brian, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. That was Brian Killoran from the Emigrant Council of Ireland.
It's 7 minutes to eight on Morning Ireland. Let's get all the business news now from Brian Finn. Morning, Brian.
Thanks, Audrey. Good morning. We got a good insight yesterday into the extent of the economic deterioration arising from the COVID shutdown with the unemployment numbers and the exchequer returns. Business group IBEC is forecasting a contraction in GDP of 11% for this year in its latest outlook. Gerard Brady is chief economist with IBEC, and you provide a table of forecasts for various measures compared to 2019, Gerard. And I think it's fair to say that we're looking at a fairly elongated recovery here.
They're all minus numbers we're looking at this morning, Brian. And if you look at the GDP number, we're saying it'll be down 11%. But on the domestic side of the economy, consumer spending and business investment will be down closer to 20%. So there's a significant shock coming from COVID that's already in train. And what we're also saying, if you look at the labour market, that it's going to take until at least 2022 before we get back down to below 7% unemployment.
You're also calling for a faster pace of reopening. But of course, there's the obvious danger of a second or subsequent waves if we open too quickly. And surely we'll be back at square one then.
I think business are going to be led by public health advice on this at the end of the day. But what we are saying is that the length of the lockdown, if you look across Europe now, we're about 6 to 8 weeks more conservative than across any other sector versus our peers. And that does have an economic impact. If it is necessary from a public health point of view, it means we're going to have to run a bigger deficit. And it means that more of that deficit is going to go towards lower tax revenues rather than boosting the economy and getting us back up and running. So there are long-term implications. So what we're saying is that needs to be examined and brought forward to June, if at all possible and safe under public health guidelines.
And what about supports for businesses? A series of measures have been introduced already. Businesses say, though, they don't want debt in the form of loans. So is there an argument here for credit guarantee schemes or state guaranteed loans?
So there have been announcements of schemes by the government, but their hands are tied with some of that legislation until we get a new government. So it's important that we get a new government in place and that these schemes are put in place really quickly once that new government does get in place. But on the other hand, there are schemes out there at the moment that aren't working for business because they're less generous, particularly on the loan side, than what we've seen in other countries like Germany, Switzerland, and the UK. In the UK, we've seen their bounce back loan scheme get about 600,000 take up. Our loan schemes here have seen 500 companies take them up so far because they can get better terms directly from their banks. So that needs to change and doesn't need a new government to do it.
And the temporary wage schemes, they can't go on forever, obviously.
They can't, but we think that that the best thing to do would be to extend the wage subsidy out until October and maybe longer for some sectors which are going to struggle to reopen under distancing. The main reason for that is that if you remove those supports too quickly from the economy, you risk making the downturn worse. And before, if you remove them before demand normalizes, what you risk is triggering a wave of redundancy. So we've said to the government they should extend them out to October, and it will be costly, but the alternative to the wage subsidy scheme is paying more in unemployment payments. So it doesn't save the state a huge amount of money to have a lot of people unemployed.
Just briefly, Jared, one interesting figure here is the outlook on savings. It's always high here, but particularly so in recent months. Is there a pent-up spending potential there that may boost the recovery?
So because of the income supports from government, we've seen incomes as a whole not fall by that much, but spending has fallen really significantly. In April, there was a 3 billion jump in savings by Irish households versus March. A chunk of money that will be out there at the end of this, it's really important that the next government make sure that it's spent in the domestic economy and that we see measures in the programme for government that encourage that rather than leaking out of the country either through online or in spending abroad over the coming year. So it's a big opportunity actually to help boost the economy again by getting those savings back into the domestic economy later this year.
Jared Brady, Chief Economist with IBEC, thank you very much. More business news at 8:30. Brian.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, June the 4th, and this is Morning Ireland with Brian Dobson and Audrey Carville. Let's get the news. It's read now by Brian Jennings.
Health officials are meeting today to conclude advice they'll give to the government on the scheduled easing of COVID-19 restrictions in 4 days' time. Under phase two of the government's roadmap, it's envisaged that from next week, people will be able to increase the distance they can travel from home from 5 kilometres to 20 kilometres. Up to 4 people will be allowed to visit another household, but for a short period. Marts, libraries and retail outlets will be allowed to reopen their doors, so long as certain social distancing measures were met. The National Public Health Emergency Team, NPHET, will also discuss guidelines on nursing home visits. Our correspondent, Sinead Crowley, reports.
Phase 2 of the easing of coronavirus restrictions is due to begin next Monday. The final decision rests with government, and they take advice from the National Public Health Emergency Team, which meets today. At a briefing at the Department of Health last night, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Houlihan said there's nothing in the data so far to suggest that NPHET won't recommend moving to phase 2. However, he added that the third week of each stage is the crucial one, and it's important to wait till the end of this week before making a decision. Other issues due to be discussed at the NPHET meeting are measures aimed at easing the pressure on children, including the possibility of summer camps, visits to nursing homes and the control of the transmission of the virus among health workers.
The employers group IBEC has said further significant measures will be needed over the coming months to protect businesses and households from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 outbreak. In its latest quarterly economic report, IBEC says that high levels of unemployment among young people may become a stubborn issue to try to resolve. Our economics correspondent, Robert Short.
IBEC claims Ireland's roadmap to reopening the economy is more conservative than almost all comparable countries. Its latest quarterly outlook says the duration of restrictions will determine the scale of the fall in economic activity. It warns that high levels of youth unemployment may become an intractable problem. It points out that the accommodation and hospitality sector is amongst the worst hit, with an estimated 69% of workers in receipt of the COVID-19 payment. It expects unemployment overall to remain high, only falling to 16% by the end of this year. It urges the government to only withdraw income supports gradually or risk a wave of redundancies in companies still operating well below capacity.
The former US Defence Secretary James Mattis has criticised President Donald Trump over his threat to use heavily armed soldiers to tackle violent protests triggered by the death of a black man, George Floyd, in police custody in Minneapolis. Mr. Mattis, a former Marine Corps general, said that instead of trying to unite the country, Mr. Trump was attempting to divide citizens. He said the US was witnessing the consequences of 3 years without mature leadership. Mr. Trump replied by Twitter, describing Mr. Mattis as the world's most overrated general. Talks on government formation will continue today as the parties involved seek to reach an agreement by early next week. The leaders of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party will meet TDs from the regional group later. A search is underway this morning for a young boy who was reported to have fallen into the River Boyne in Drogheda in County Louth last night. A search operation was stood down in the early hours but resumed at first light. Our northeast correspondent, Sinead Hussey.
Gardaí say they were alerted to a report that a young boy had fallen into the River Boyne under the Bridge of Peace in Drogheda at around 10:15 last night. It's understood a number of witnesses contacted Gardaí. An extensive search of the area was carried out. The Coast Guard helicopter and volunteer divers from Drogheda River Rescue were involved in the operation, which was stood down in the early hours. The search resumed this morning. Sinead Hussey, RTÉ News, Drogheda.
Police in Germany are due to give further details today about a suspect in the disappearance of Madeleine McCann 13 years ago. Officers are expected to outline links between the suspect, a convicted sex offender, and the 3-year-old who went missing in Portugal in 2007. The 43-year-old man, who hasn't been named, is known to have been in the same area when Madeleine went missing. It's understood he used to live in the Algarve, working as a handyman and sleeping in a camper van. German police say he used his phone in Praia da Luz, the area where the McCanns were staying, an hour before Madeleine was last seen. Investigators say that a Jaguar car he owned was re-registered to a friend the following day. He's currently in jail in Germany for unrelated offences. Christian Hoppe from Germany's Federal Criminal Police Office gave more details on the man on the country's ZDF television channel.
He is a German citizen. He was 30 when Madeleine disappeared. He's in prison in Germany because of a sexual crime and drug offences. Between 1995 and 2007, he lived almost exclusively in Portugal. He has 2 previous convictions for the sexual assault of girls.
Now the time is 8:07.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with SuperValue. Home cooking is more important than ever lately, so get inspired with thousands of tasty recipes on supervalue.ie.
It'll be cloudy at first. Light showers in the north and west will spread to all areas. Rainfall amounts will be small, however, and parts of the southeast may stay dry. It'll brighten up later this afternoon. There'll be sunny spells by this evening as showers become isolated. Highest temperatures will range from 13 to 16 degrees.
Let's take a check on the weather prospects for the day ahead. Gavin Gallagher is at Metair. Good morning, Gavin.
Good morning, Brian, and welcome to Metair and HQ. So starting off rather cloudy this morning with outbreaks of light showery rain in the north and west spreading to all areas. Rainfall amounts today will be small, however, and some parts of the southeast may stay dry altogether. Brightening up later this afternoon with a few bright spells by evening as showers become isolated. Highs today off around 13 to 16 degrees. Coolest in the north and west due to a moderate northwest wind, which will be fresh and gusty near coasts. Then largely dry overnight tonight with clear spells. However, there will be scattered showers also, and these becoming frequent in Ulster towards dawn. Lows tonight of around 6 to 10 degrees and a light to moderate northwest breeze. Then tomorrow will be cool and blustery with sunny spells and showers. The showers will become widespread and they will be most frequent and heaviest in the north of the country, becoming mostly dry in southern parts later tomorrow, but remaining rather showery further north. Maximum temperatures tomorrow of only 11 to 13 degrees in Ulster and North Connacht, 14 to 16 degrees elsewhere, and northwesterly winds strengthening through the day tomorrow with gales possible on northeastern coasts by late evening. Then becoming wet and windy on Friday night and Saturday morning, and especially so in the north and northeast of the country, and it will be unseasonably cold, wet and windy for this time of year. The rain will clear to showers later Saturday, and it will be cool also with highs of around only 11 to 15 degrees on Saturday. Sunday will be the better day of the weekend. It'll be dry and bright and a little milder than previous days, with highs on Sunday of around 14 to 19 degrees. That's your forecast. Have a good day.
13 years after her disappearance while on holiday with her family in Portugal, Madeleine McCann is pictured on the front of no fewer than five papers. As you've been hearing in news bulletins, a German prisoner has been identified as the prime suspect in the case, which the Irish Independent describes as the biggest breakthrough to date. The Irish Daily Star reports the unnamed 43-year-old lived in a camper van at the time in the same area on the Algarve coast where Madeleine went missing. The camper van is pictured on the front of the Irish Sun, which asks, did German take Maddie in this van? While the Irish Daily Mail says detectives have launched an information appeal about the van, as well as a Jaguar car seen in the area that's linked to the suspect. The Irish Times reports public health officials are set to give the go-ahead today for a further easing of COVID restrictions, resuming certain special education classes and allowing summer camps to go ahead are set to be among the measures. Also in the Times, a report that one in seven care homes named in confidential HSE documents have questioned the accuracy of the data, which they say incorrectly attributed COVID-19 deaths to them. The data, prepared by the Health Protection Surveillance Centre and presented to the board of the HSE, described more than 1,000 deaths associated with the disease across 167 long-term residential care facilities. After the Times published the list last week, it says 24 homes contacted the paper to query the figures. The Independent reports the pandemic unemployment payment for part-time workers will be reduced by 40% as part of the government's plan to cut the welfare bill that's built up due to the coronavirus situation. It says the €350 weekly payment will fall to €203 in line with job seekers' allowance. The Belfast Telegraph leads with reopening proposals from primary schools in Northern Ireland. Among the measures, which the paper says a number of Belfast schools have come up with in the absence of official guidance, are daily temperature checks, a two-day school week and emotional well-being lessons. The Irish Examiner says November 12th has been set as the date for the reopening of Douglas Shopping Centre in Cork, which closed last August after a major fire destroyed a key part of the retail complex. Catherine Shanahan writes this will see the reinstatement of 1,000 much-needed car parking spaces, as well as the reopening of 46 commercial units. Elsewhere, the Examiner reports Fine Gael wants greenhouse gases linked to cattle emitted from emission calculations targeted by the Green Party in government negotiations. The Times, meanwhile, says independent TDs have been offered deals similar to that given to former Kerry independent Jackie Healy-Ray in order to support a coalition. Such an agreement, which would involve local deals for individual TDs as well as access to ministers, was reportedly made at a meeting between the leaders of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, which was attended by deputies Marion Harkin, Michael Fitzmaurice and Michael McNamara. The Irish Farmers Journal also has details of this week's talks, reporting Fine Gael has proposed that carbon tax revenue be dedicated to a new agri-environmental programme. It says the move would see farmers rewarded for initiatives such as reducing farm emissions and enhancing biodiversity. Separately, the Farmers Journal reports some 1,048 workers in meat and poultry plants have tested positive for coronavirus, adding 200 HSE officials are to be reassigned to the Health and Safety Authority to inspect workplaces following a backlash over the lack of inspections in meat factories. Finally, though, to the letter pages in the Times, where Keith Nolan from Carrick-on-Shannon, County Leitrim, notes Dalkey in County Dublin seems to be making national news these days. First, there was an extended stay from Hollywood film star Matt Damon, and now a hole has appeared on one of its streets, Mr. Nolan writes, adding, it's all so exciting for us, so far away from these momentous events. On the sinkhole, Norman Lowther in Raheny in Dublin suggests perhaps it was caused by the mat being pulled out from under them. While Dalkey resident Paul Delaney asks, are Gardaí looking into it?
Unprecedented curfews remain in major cities across the United States. Tens of thousands of people have been on the streets again overnight, and dissent within the US government grows over the use of military force against the people protesting the death of George Floyd, the African American who died after being pinned to the ground by a white police officer who held his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for 9 minutes. The Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, said he does not back President Trump's plan to use the military. And overnight, in a rare public statement, Mr. Trump's former defense secretary, James Mattis, accused him of stoking division and abusing his authority. Former presidents Obama, Bush and Carter have all criticized the Trump administration's response to the protests. In a virtual town hall meeting, Mr. Obama called on every mayor across the United States to review their use of force policies by the police.
So today I am urging every mayor in this country to review your use of force policies with members of your community and commit to report on planned reforms. So we need mayors, county executives, others who are in positions of power to say this is a priority. This is a specific response.
Well, Kevin O'Malley is a former U.S. ambassador to Ireland during President Obama's term in office. And Melanie McAllister is a professor of U.S. studies at George Washington University. What do the events of the past 10 days tell them about their country at this moment in time?
Well, it tells me that we are in a country in a crisis around race once again, and that this crisis has been exacerbated by all the things that are going on with COVID and with the pandemic globally, but that the real issue is policing and police violence that's been going on since the U.S. began at some level, but in the last 5 years since the founding of Black Lives Matter, people have been protesting and complaining about what's been going on, and so little has been done, and now we're seeing the results of the ongoing failure to address violence against Black people in this country.
Kevin O'Malley, what do the events of the past 10 days tell you?
They tell me primarily that we lack a compassionate leadership at the top of our country at the moment. We've had problems of race, just not as it relates to violence and policing, but education and availability of health care that have plagued us as a result of slavery. And that is a big issue in the United States, as all of your listeners who've been here have seen and now is on full display for the rest of the world. I think that I'm optimistic about what's going to come out of this. I think we'll be a better country for having addressed this, but it's difficult to do it right now, and especially since we don't have the kind of national leadership that I think would be helpful here in unifying rather than dividing our citizens.
Professor McAllister, have you been shocked by the scale of the protests, or do you believe it was inevitable?
Well, I think we're always surprised when the one thing that sort of is the tipping point happens, because there have been so many incidences of violence, particularly against Black men, but also against Black women and also Latino men and Native American and Arabs and others. And so it's surprising to me that when it happened, this particular case, and at the same time, it did seem like we've been seeing the anger and the frustration and the lack of action build up over and over in the past 5-10 years, as we've also not only seen the police violence, but literally seen more of it with social media and with cell phones, so that a lot of people who knew about the reality of police violence against African Americans in day-to-day life, because they were from those communities, now a lot of other Americans are becoming much more aware of what people are facing as part of the ordinary course of events. So I'm not surprised that something spilled over. You never know when it's going to happen.
And Kevin O'Malley, you mentioned there in your first answer about the education, the health, the economic discriminations against African Americans and other people of color since the days of slavery. And I mean, is it good enough in the year 2020 for us still to be talking about this, for this to be still so embedded in US society?
Well, of course not. No, this is we are continually striving to build, as President Obama would say, a more perfect union. You know, we're not a perfect people. We have problems. But, for example, I mean, I grew up in the 60s, so these sorts of demonstrations are nothing new to me. But what's different as I watch the demonstrations across the United States in the last week, how many people of all colors are joining in these marches and are protesting, you know, wealthy white people, white officers taking a knee in support of the protesters. That is a good sign that we are, in fact, coming together. And of course, we're not where we ought to be, but we're making strides in that direction. President Obama pointed that out today in his in the little town hall that he had with the young African-American supporters, that we have made strides. We must continue to make strides.
And Barack Obama, obviously an African-American president in the White House for 8 years, did he really do enough to help change the system, that system which continues to lock African-Americans out of education, healthcare, the ability to start a business, the ability to buy a house?
Absolutely. The Affordable Care Act, for one, I mean, the first president of our country who was able to, with federal legislation, make health care available to many otherwise uninsured people in the United States, you know, that alone would mark him as a victor in this. But all of his use of the Department of Justice, and the revival of the Civil Rights Division of the department, what he was able to do simply by his example, was able to lift up and demonstrate to African Americans that with hard work, there were opportunities in the United States to go to the very top level.
Professor McAllister, do you agree with that, or do you believe that President Obama, just like all other previous administrations, have as much responsibility for where we are today?
Well, I think that President Obama did many important things, both symbolically by being a black man in the White House and in terms of some of the policy decisions that his administration made. But I also think that he faced an incredible backlash. And I would argue that the backlash he faced was because he was a black president. And our current president played a role in that. The accusation that he wasn't a citizen was current President Trump was one of the leaders of the accusation that Obama was not a citizen. And the backlash against him really did also tie his hands. And also, in some sense, the problem is so much bigger than what one president can do. The issues of militarized policing, for example, the groundwork has been laid for a very long time with that. But it was under the Obama administration that police departments began buying military equipment and been getting donated military equipment. And that was a policy that was designed to, you know, help equip police departments, but which actually encouraged an ongoing militarization of police departments. So I think that President Obama suffered a lot from racism and was limited in what he could do because of that. I also think he could have done more.
So Professor McAllister,
President Obama stopped that policy. Yeah, that policy known as the 1033 policy, President Obama actually stopped during his administration, and President Trump reignited it again when he took over selling military type equipment to local police officers and police departments, which has put an extra wall between police officers and the public that they serve, and it's made it more militaristic, which is really, as the former Secretary of Defense today stated, is a huge mistake.
So, Professor McAllister, listening to what you both have been saying, it's very hard to have any hope that when these protests end, much, if anything, will have changed.
Oh, I disagree with that.
Well, I also, I agree with the ambassador that there it is hopeful when people are marching together on the streets and trying to make change and speaking out against what has happened, and that we've seen real anger from a lot of different people across the United States at the kind of violence that is being enacted in Minneapolis and in other places against black men who are caught up in the on the wrong side of the police. But I think that whether this actually leads to real sustained change, I think is a real question, and it's a matter of people following up, because we thought after Trayvon Martin was killed or after Michael Brown was killed, we saw protest and we saw black and white people coming together to protest, and then a lot of things did not change. So it's really a matter of whether people are willing, once the news isn't there, the cameras aren't there, whether they're still willing to do the work of holding police departments accountable, holding themselves accountable around issues of race, dealing with some of those other issues that the ambassador was speaking about in terms of economic disparities, political disparities, the health disparities that were making such a difference right now in terms of COVID-19, and really talking about this as an issue of systemic racism that can't be fixed in a week or a year or even probably a decade.
Kevin O'Malley, why do you think things will change?
Well, I think you have to keep in mind that this is a country of 330 million people, so we don't change quickly. Change for us is always going to be slow. But and I know that your listeners pay a great deal of attention to the news in the United States, and you've seen the terrible divisiveness that we've had. But I hope that that your listeners will listen to the speech that Vice President Biden gave yesterday in Philadelphia, and you'll see there the America that you know and that you remember and that you know, the values that he espoused, the compassion, the empathy, the condemnation of the rioting and the looting, but the understanding of the underlying problems. And that's the America that Ireland knows and loves. And 5 months from today, we have a scheduled election, which gives me hope that we will be able to address these problems in a national way, in a unified way, in a compassionate way that we Americans can be proud of.
Final word from you on this, Professor McAllister.
I would like to believe that change is possible and that the work that people have done over decades to fight against racism and discrimination in the United States really has made a difference and will continue to do so. But I also think that this is a bigger issue than what's going to happen in the November election. We've had Democrats and Republicans in power, and racism has continued apace for the last many decades in the United States. It's gotten better in some ways. In other ways, we can see real ongoing and systemic inequalities that are quite disturbing in 2020. So I would hope that we can see people make a commitment to do more than just vote. They should do that, but also really take a hard look at what it takes to actually change systemic and structural racism.
Our thanks to Professor Melanie McAllister of George Washington University and to Kevin O'Malley, former US Ambassador to Ireland. It's 8:27.
Now, it is 117 days today since the general election, and of course a government has yet to be formed. But while there is growing public and political frustration at the delay, some potentially significant steps are finally taking place, however slowly. Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens are believed to be close to drawing up a draft programme for government, which, if they can get it over the line with their party members, could be given to the wider party membership to consider. And the fourth leg of the long-referenced coalition stool, the independents, are now being spoken to, if not quite spoken with. Policy and spending initiatives rather than ministerial seats are rumoured to be on the table. Our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni has the details. Very good morning, Fiacra. Now, first of all, the talks between the three parties, Fine Gael, Fine Gael and the Greens, where are we now in relation to those?
Yes. Morning, Brian. Well, as you said, some progress is finally being made, but that doesn't mean we're forming a government just yet. Divisive issues remain remain to be agreed and include agriculture, the 7% emissions reduction target, which is so important for the Greens, transport, and repaying state debt, the latter of which was referenced by Leo Varadkar in an email to TDs last night. A draft programme for government could be ready by next week, and a new government could be formed by the end of June. But previous deadlines have, of course, been broken. Talks are also, as you said, taking place with three independent groups between now and the weekend, but they are not as simple as first thought, with limited support from opposition rather than ministerial positions on offer.
So these independents that, if you like, are coming more into focus now, who are they? Who's involved in this?
Sure. Well, there are three independent groups. There are the eight TD regional independents, the six TD rural independents, and the three TD independent group. These groups first met with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in March, but they have basically been ignored until now. The independent group met Leo Varadkar, Micheál Martin and Eamon Ryan yesterday. The regional independents will meet the same leaders today, but the rural independents, and they are not too happy with this, they have to wait until Monday.
So what are they saying to the parties, and what are the parties saying to them?
Well, I've spoken with 14 independents in the past day, and they say while they're open to talks, they are unhappy with the lack of detail and the limited deals that appear to be on offer from the parties. The regional independents will meet the three party leaders this afternoon. As we'll hear now, that group's convener, Dennis Nocton, told me his group members won't be picked off if side deals are put forward by the parties.
So can we hear Dennis Nocton? Have we got that?
Close to 100 days ago, we contacted the three main parties. We said we'd make ourselves available to engage in talks on a programme for government. We now have been invited in by the three party leaders later today, and we'll hear what they have to say. What we'd like to hear is an update on the progress today, on their discussions on the programme for government. I think the public needs to hear that progress has been made and that we're nearer to the formation of a government. Over 3 months ago, we decided to work together as a group of eight independent TDs, and we've been working quite closely together over that period of time. But very much the ball is in the court of the three party leaders, and look, we're open to hear what they have to say to us.
Now, Dennis's view, people won't be picked off, it's not shared by all of his colleagues, a number of whom have privately told me that they may in fact be open to individual deals from the parties. But while interest in only some TDs is a problem for the regional independents, the problem for the second independent group, the rural independents, is, as organiser Matthew McGrath told me last night, no interest at all.
Well, we had talks initially with them, but since they started talking with the Greens and Fianna Fáil, they haven't even wanted to look sideways at us. So I feel a bit frustrated, and I'm sure my colleagues in the rural independents, you know, we're willing and ready to talk, but we're not being engaged with. And I think it's high past time that they either started our programme for government, give us a look at it, or ask us what we think of it, or else just, I don't know, desist from the process altogether, because it's farcical at this stage. I had some contact yesterday with the Green Party Secretary, our member of staff, who contacted me on behalf of the government. So we wanted to meet either this evening in Dublin later or tomorrow, or indeed Friday, Saturday or Sunday. And we're being told that we're not wanted until Monday. Are they trying to pick people off from groups and get them on board? I don't know, but something very funny about what's going on.
Matty's concern there's something very funny going on is shared by the third independent group, which met with party leaders yesterday and were less than impressed with what they heard. Group member Michael McNamara told me he is none the wiser about what a new government would involve.
I'm no wiser as to what's going to be in the programme for government. I mean, I submitted a document highlighting my priorities, but that was immediately after the election. I mean, that seems like a different world now. We were told that elements of what we proposed might be contained in the programme for government, but really we're no wiser as to what will be in the programme for government and what won't, and whether it'll be a detailed document or whether it'll be a sort of a cursory aspirational document. We need to be very clear about what would be expected of independence by a government, whether it would be to be sort of subject to the government whip and all votes, or whether it would be a confidence and supply type arrangement, or what exactly would be required.
The frustration from a number of independents is because the independent group last night were offered an arm's length support from opposition deal rather than full coalition membership. That deal is similar to what was offered to the late Kerry TD Jackie Healy-Rae and former Wicklow TD Mildred Fox in the 1990s and 2000s. The TDs, Mildred Fox and Jackie Healy-Rae, were given at the time direct access to ministers, specific narrow sweeteners for their constituencies and other favoured treatment. So infamously, roads for Kerry in Mr Healy-Rae's case. Those deals in 2020 could work for independents, but some of those independents in 2020 may have a problem with not being ministers or formerly in power.
Right, so where does all this leave us? Where are we at?
Well, it leaves us in two places, really. In terms of the parties themselves, they're slowly moving towards a draft programme for government and may have a deal next week, although expect a few more bumps in the road between now and then. Separately, the independents look destined to face a fait accompli to sign up to a deal to support government from opposition only. This is likely because, unlike in 2016 with the Independent Alliance, in 2020 the three political parties have enough TDs to form a government without the independents, meaning the independents do not have the balance of power. It's not exactly what many independents will have been hoping for over the past 117 days since the general election, but the structure at least of a potential new government, if one is to be formed, is at least finally taking shape.
Fiacre O'Connor, thank you very much indeed for that.
Jury's is to start a phased reopening of its hotels as a cashless operation from the middle of next month. Check-in will be online and there will be room service for food and drink requests. The bars and restaurants will remain closed. Activity in the services sector remained under pressure in May, although the rate of decline eased compared to the record collapse in April, according to the latest measure from AIB. The monthly reading here was below that of comparable surveys carried out across the Eurozone and the UK. AIB says this is consistent with containment measures being unwound at a slower pace here than elsewhere. Mortgage approvals were down over 40% in April in volume and value terms, according to the Banking and Payments Federation. 2,200 mortgages to the value of €525 million were approved in the month. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.12 and 89.5 pence sterling.
Sports news and a sporting memory now from Darren. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Audrey. Minister for Sport Shane Ross has given his full backing to the current FAI board after a letter of complaint was sent to UEFA and FIFA from a member of their senior council. Delegate Nixon Morton is unhappy with the number of issues and the direction the organisation is taking.
We want to see a complete clear out of the board. We got that clear out of the board. And we now have a situation where there's going to be a six-all division, as I understand it. It's going to be totally reformed and the independents will have the casting vote. It is absolutely vital for us that there is not a return of the old guard. And those people who are today kicking up and writing letters to UEFA and that, I think that's what their agenda is. It's actually a return of the old guard and the FAI. Well, we're not going to allow that to happen if we can do anything about it. When Roy Barrett's name came up and I saw it, I was absolutely delighted because I knew he didn't belong to the old guard. He wasn't part of that and he was going to be reformist. And I was equally delighted when they appointed the independent directors, none of whom I think I knew at all, but who were obviously independent as well. Football needs reform. Football needs money, but it also needs reform. Government money was not going to go unless football was properly reformed. We got it in the end, and we hope to see more of it in the next few months. We've also got a situation with the chief executive, who was appointed as an interim chief executive, is now his job is being advertised. There's going to be a full, clean process, the like of which you've never seen before in the FAI. I'm very encouraged with the results. I'm very disappointed that somebody has written to UEFA and FIFA and said, look, they want the old ways back. We don't want that. We want this reform. We want football to flourish, but we must see proper governance in Irish football if that's to happen.
RTE Sport understands that GAA clubs will be able to apply to open walkways around their premises from next Monday. If successful, the walkways can only be open for 4 hours a day and must be supervised at all times. Designated times will be allocated for vulnerable people. The walkway will not be allowed for group or team training. Now, this morning, we're remembering Ireland's win away to France in the Six Nations way back in 2000, the day Brian O'Driscoll scored that hat-trick. Now, the RTE team there on that day were correspondent Tommy Gorman, cameraman Paul Regarts, and the technicians Tom Drury and Jared Tierney. They managed to beam images live from the winning dressing room into the 6-1 news. Sure, what could go wrong? Well, Tommy's interview with Brian O'Driscoll, during it, Guy Easterby walks into shot without a stitch of clothing or a towel in sight. All I'll say is that bulletin would give ordinary people, or normal people rather, a run for its money. I've posted the edited version of that video on Twitter, but let's hear what happened on the field from the man of the moment himself.
My first memories of playing rugby, when I joined Willow Park as a 12-year-old, my first ever training session, I was put in second row. Needless to say, once I got out to the backs, it was where I really cemented my position then as a winger at the time.
In goal Ireland, and it's Stringer leaving it outside, and here's a chance for O'Driscoll. O'Driscoll is in at the post. A beautiful try for Ireland.
To go and beat the French by 2 points, you know, the first time in 28 years was a fantastic feeling, and I can still look back at pictures and look at our faces and the final whistle, and it's kind of a look of disbelief.
Ireland win the ball, get it back to Stringer, to O'Gara, and this time it's Henderson bursting forward, gives it inside, and here's O'Driscoll in for a second try. What a superb try!
Accomplishing something that teams have really struggled, Irish teams have struggled to do for the best part of 3 decades, so we are absolutely overwhelmed.
Referee giving advantage to Brian O'Driscoll. Brian O'Driscoll's running in for another try. Brian O'Driscoll is in. What a superb try again. He gets a hat-trick of tries. Does Brian O'Driscoll and Ireland have narrowed the gap again?
I think I'd have to say the third try would stick out most of all. What most people don't realise is I shouldn't have been where I was. As the ball dropped at my feet, I think I was trying to catch a bit of a breather and I couldn't get out into position. So as the ball squirted in front of me, I kind of got a second wind and realised that there was a gap in front.
Referee says it's all over. Ireland have beaten France in Stade de France. And the Irish players hug each other. They jump high in the air. They hold their hands aloft. And nobody is held higher than Brian O'Driscoll, who scored those 3 Irish tries.
Oh, my mama told me they'll be dead like this.
Brian O'Driscoll and memories of 2000. The holiday season proper begins in Portugal this weekend with the opening of what is described as the country's bathing season. Beaches, bars and restaurants will be back in business, but with rules on social distancing and restrictions on the type of activities that holidaymakers can engage in. Irish people who travel to Portugal or anywhere else will, under current restrictions, be asked to self-quarantine for 14 days on their return. The Chief Medical Officer, Tony Houlihan, says non-essential travel into and out of Ireland should be avoided for the foreseeable future. Let's talk to Rita Marquez, who's Portugal's Secretary of State for Tourism, is on the line now. A very good morning to you, and thanks for talking to us this morning.
Hello, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. I think people will well know that tourism is hugely important for the Portuguese economy. What are you planning this weekend to try to reopen your tourism industry?
Yes, in fact, it is very important for us, but I guess, you know, tourism is important for everyone, including the Irish people that would like very much to travel abroad. So, yes, we are in this third phase of the opening up all the economy, all the activities in the economy. So the last phase is going to be in 2 days, because the beaches will open on June 6th. And as from that day on, everything will be open, including hotels, bars, restaurants, and beaches.
Right. So how then are you approaching the question of keeping people safe, maintaining social distance, and ensuring that as much as possible is done to prevent transmission of the virus?
So the health authority has established a set of rules. So basically, you know, everybody is asked to use a mask in public transports. Physical distancing should be mandatory as well, so 1.5 meters. And for the beaches, basically we defined a couple of simple rules. So the beaches will have a kind of a traffic light signs in the entrance, so people will know if the beach is with a low occupancy rate. If the traffic light sign is green, or if it has full capacity, mm-hmm. with red light sign. So basically, we have we are now communicating in a very assertive and clear way to everyone what are the rules. and we really hope people obey, and everything will be fine.
And if the light, for example, is red, will people be turned away, or is it up to them to make a decision?
It's up to them to make the decision. So nobody is going to be, you know, prevented to get into the beach. So far, we had a very good response to the pandemic disease, and because people obeyed the rules. And so people are being respectful, and we hope that people will continue to be respectful of the rules.
And
if you get to the beach and you get the riot sign, you can get in, but you are not recommended to get in.
And is that, if you like, approach self-regulation, people making their own decisions, is that the way you're going to deal with people maintaining distance in bars and restaurants as well, or will there be stricter regulation there? No.
Basically, we have been working with the companies, with restaurant owners, so they know the rules, but there is a lot of auto-imposed rules. And so, again, we are already investing a lot in communicating all the rules, and people will be responsible enough. We trust that people will be responsible enough to adopt those rules. And even the policemen, and they are being very pedagogical, so even the approach that they make to the society, to the population, they're very pedagogical approach, trying to instigate everybody to follow rules and not to fine or to make infringement process. That's not the case.
Of course, the other issue for Irish holidaymakers is that if they do travel abroad to Portugal or anywhere else and then return home, they'll be asked to quarantine at home, to self-quarantine for 14 days. So does that, in effect, make it impossible for Irish holidaymakers to be visiting Portugal as long as that remains in place?
I think, you know, we are open up, all the countries are open up gradually. So I trust that rule, that quarantine rule here in Ireland will be revised soon. That's the information that I have, and probably that's information that you also have. So our main message is that we in Portugal welcome everybody that would like to spend holidays in Portugal. The flights are starting, so we do have weekly flights to and from Ireland. In July, we'll have 25 flights weekly. So we believe that, you know, those rules will gradually be revised, and that all the conditions will be there, will be favorable, that Portugal welcomes Irish people in August or July.
Has the Portuguese government been talking to the Irish government or Irish officials or other governments about this, about maybe reciprocal arrangements?
You know, Portugal has been talking with several member states, all member states. We had several meetings, joint meetings with all the ministers involved, foreign affairs, tourism, and we believe that also the Commission, the European Commission, will help to have a coordinated approach to the opening of the related to the opening of the borders.
I suppose it's that a lot of these regulations that we've been talking about are there obviously to protect people and keep them safe. And Portugal, as you say, has had some success in containing the virus. I think it's 1,400 deaths, 33,000 infections. Do you risk putting that at risk as a result now of this move to begin to open things up?
We don't want to put jeopardize anything that, you know, the huge effort that all of us Portuguese people have done. We don't want to jeopardize that. But at this stage, we also know that it's very important to give a trust, to give a confidence message to everyone. And we believe that we are in the position of starting opening up the borders, welcoming everyone that would like very much to visit Portugal, as long as we have all the measures in place. So, for instance, at the airports, in restaurants, in the beaches, and that's what we have done so far. So all the conditions are clear for us, and we need to communicate those conditions to everybody that would like to visit the country.
Well, thank you for talking to us this morning. That was Rita Marquez, Portugal's Secretary of State for Tourism, at 8:53.
And if you've been paying attention, you may have noticed there are more butterflies around. Those who study such things say the population is up by 10%. The figures are from the National Biodiversity Data Centre. Cian McCormack's report begins with an introduction to counting butterflies in an enthusiast's garden.
Under the clear blue sky, bees are buzzing.
We're on the foot of the Three Rock Mountain in South Dublin.
David and Anne Burnett are walking their 2.5-acre garden.
It includes a large fruit and veg area and flowering shrubs and bushes and plants and flowers, together with some wild areas, which the butterflies actually love as well.
That's a lantern tree. It's got red flowers that hang down like a lantern.
Flowers are in colourful bloom.
The colours are sensational.
This is a viburnum and it's white. An azalea, the pink one there.
David is taking part in the National Garden Butterfly Survey, which is run by the National Biodiversity Data Centre.
What I am doing is, when conditions suit, to carry out a butterfly count for only 15 minutes per day. The conditions today are probably excellent. It needs a temperature of minimum of 15 and to have less cloud cover, maybe like today, some sunshine, great sunshine, and no breeze.
This is last Tuesday, just before the weather broke.
We've just seen a butterfly.
We have indeed. That was probably from this distance a small white.
The survey started when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and it has provided hours of entertainment during cocooning.
A long-time good friend, Malcolm Taylor, he signed up, two of us, another good friend, Terry Forsyth, and myself, to take part in the pilot scheme for counting butterflies in our gardens. Along came COVID-19, lockdown. The three of us qualified quite easily to be in the Owl Guys age group of confined to barracks, with the result that this pilot scheme is great from our point of view. It gives us the opportunity to actually do it.
David competes against his friends to see who can count the most butterflies in their own gardens.
So who's leading out of the three of you now at this stage?
I think in total I might be just ahead. I have done 18 counts, of which 14 were successful.
The garden survey has shown species of white butterflies are the most commonly seen in May. Dr. Liam Lysett is the director for the National Biodiversity Data Centre.
Well, it shows that, as probably as expected, in May at least, the white butterflies are the most commonly seen. But this will change as the season progresses.
It's one of many projects focusing on butterfly populations. Another is the Irish Butterfly Monitoring Scheme, which has run for 12 years, and its results are out today.
Well, we've just finished the analysis for 2019, and the numbers show that there was a small drop in populations from the previous year, but 2018 was a bumper year for butterflies. Perhaps the most stunning result really was the number of painted lady butterflies that we found in 2019. The painted lady is one of our larger ones. It's kind of orange with mottled colouring on it. These are migratory butterflies that come to us from continental Europe every year. And there were 600% more recorded in 2019 than the base year in 2008. So it was really the year of the painted lady. I suppose it's important to point out that in the last 5 years, we've seen a 10% increase in overall butterfly populations.
The health of our butterfly species in Ireland, does it reflect the way we live?
It can tell us in factors about how we manage the countryside. Definitely this spring, because of the pandemic lockdown, there's been a lot less mowing of public spaces and the like. And that's going to have a very big positive impact, I think, on all types of insect life, in particular butterflies. Really, these are indicators of how sensitively we manage the countryside. And we'd expect to see more and more butterflies increasing in populations if we're managing the countryside more sympathetically for nature.
And that was Cian McCormack reporting there. It's 1:59 to 9.